Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
In a quiet town called Rivertown, in the middle of America, something really scary happened at the local shopping mall. The mall was usually a busy and lively place, but one Monday afternoon, everything changed when there was suddenly a lot of gunfire. This shocked the whole community. The trouble started in a Starbucks cafe, where people usually go to relax and have their favorite coffee drinks. But on this day, everything went wrong. Instead of the usual calm and familiar atmosphere, the sound of a gunshot filled the air, making everyone in the mall scared and surprised. It turned an ordinary day into a really sad and frightening situation. Mary Thompson, a 30-year-old graphic designer, was at the mall sipping her favorite Starbucks drink when the shooting started. Everything became chaotic, and Mary felt stuck, unable to move. She saw a middle-aged man looking tense standing in the terrace area. People around her were panicking as they saw another man fall, a red stain spreading on his chest. Mary was scared, and her hands were shaking as she held on to her coffee cup, trying to understand what was happening. People around Mary were talking in hushed voices and gasping in fear, trying to find a safe place or hiding behind tables. Despite the chaos, Mary felt a strong urge to figure out what was going on. She cautiously walked closer to where the incident occurred, keeping an eye on both the fallen man and the person responsible. Mary approached a scared woman who was huddled in fear, her attention fixed on the Starbucks logo on her cup. Mary asked, "Did you see what happened?" The woman, still trembling, replied, I don't know. Everything was normal. And then suddenly this. It feels like a nightmare. Mary's heart was pounding, but she decided to get closer to the commotion, hoping to find out more about what had happened. A security guard, looking worried, hurried past her toward the scene. Mary asked the guard, "What's going on? Is he okay?" The guard, focused on keeping things under control, replied sharply, "Ma'am, I need you to stay back. The situation is dangerous," urging Mary to move away. Despite being told to stay back, Mary could still hear snippets of conversations from other people nearby. The person who got hurt was a 49-year-old man who had been enjoying his time at the Starbucks terrace when the attacker showed up. The reason for the attack was still unclear, making the whole situation in the mall uncertain and tense. As Mary got closer, she couldn't help but overhear two scared people talking to each other. "I heard he was at Starbucks. Can you believe it? Right here in our town," one person whispered. "Yeah, it's crazy. I never thought something like this could happen here." "What's the world coming to?" the second person replied, showing their disbelief in the quiet conversation. The sound of sirens got louder, indicating that the police were on their way. Police officers quickly came to the area, telling everyone to leave the mall for their own safety. Mary, feeling torn between being scared and curious, stayed near the Starbucks where the tragic event happened. A police officer came up to her looking serious. "Ma'am, we need you to leave the premises immediately. It's not safe here," he instructed. "I just want to know what happened. Was he targeted? Is the person who did this still around?" Mary asked, her concern for her community making her keep asking questions. "We're trying to figure it out. The victim was targeted, but we don't know why. The person who did it is on the run, and we're working to catch them," the officer explained before telling Mary again to leave. Outside the mall, a group of people had gathered, their faces showing a mix of shock and worry. News reporters were everywhere, asking for people who saw what happened. Mary found herself caught up in all the media attention, feeling more uneasy as she talked about what she saw inside Starbucks. "I never thought something like this would happen at our Starbucks, you know. It's supposed to be a safe place," Mary told a reporter, her voice shaky as she held on to her Starbucks cup tightly. Outside the mall, everyone was worried, and the people in the town exchanged nervous looks. A group of friends gathered together for support talked about the incident that had shaken their once quiet town. "I was just getting my usual Starbucks drink when I heard the gunshot. It feels unreal," one of them said, showing how hard it was to believe. As time passed, the town of Rivertown struggled with what happened. There were rumors and theories, and the community tried to find comfort in the fact that they were all shocked together. Starbucks, which used to be a comforting and routine place, now reminds everyone of the unexpected tragedy that happened there. Days turned into weeks, and the investigation into the shooting kept going. The person responsible was still not caught, making the town anxious. Starbucks, now decorated with makeshift memorials and messages of support, became a place where the community gathered to share their grief. Mary, haunted by the memory of that day, went back to Starbucks with a mix of fear and determination. As she drank her coffee, she overheard bits of conversations from other people there. "I can't believe it happened here, right at our Starbucks," one person quietly said, their voice showing vulnerability. "Yeah, it's like we're living in a different world now," another person replied, their eyes reflecting the shared trauma that hit the once peaceful town. Despite the adversity, the Starbucks employees worked hard to bring back a sense of normalcy. As Mary looked at the familiar faces behind the counter, she felt a bit of hope amid the ongoing uncertainty. The investigation into the shooting eventually led to the capture of the suspect. Motives were uncovered, and the town slowly began to heal. Starbucks, with its well-known logo and comforting smells, became a symbol of resilience for the community. After the tragedy, conversations changed from fear to determination. The Starbucks that had seen the unthinkable became a place where stories of survival and strength were shared. The ordinary coffee shop had turned into a sign of the unyielding spirit of a community determined to overcome tough times. As Mary sat at her usual table, looking out the Starbucks window, she couldn't help but think about the resilience of Rivertown. The town had faced a nightmare, but its people had come together, finding comfort and strength in the familiar setting of their beloved Starbucks.
Hey guys, thanks so much for all the support. If you haven't subscribed to the channel yet, please feel free to do so. The first and the last time that I ever went to the Starbucks was with my friend Nate. He told me that the coffee there is great and that I can befriend some girls in there. Though the thing with Nate was that it was all about the girls for him, and I didn't care much about that. At least, not until I actually left for college. My school were just over, and Nate was already starting the first year of college. He was a year older than me, and he was already settling into the college, and I was about to join him in the same college a year later. And Nate always told me, with girls, you want to be experienced as you can, because college is rough as an inexperienced person. And when I often asked him, isn't college for studies? And he would just say, yes, if you want to be a doctor or something, but even nerds need to have a good time in there. And even though every time he opened his mouth, he sounded like an idiot, inside, he was actually a very caring and generous man, and a great friend on top of that. To top it all off, he was an A student and have gotten into all Ivy League colleges, but ignore them. He was a legend to us, and that is why I looked up to him. He was a great mentor regardless of that shallow image that he tried to show often. Our friendship was much more than I had with everyone who was in my class, so I hang out with Nate often. Nate was the kind of person you would think would be very communist on the edge, kind of the guy. But with all the things considered, he was very much into Starbucks, and it was the same Starbucks that he would go to every time. It was weird at first when I thought about it, and then I realized that it wasn't actually the coffee that he was interested in. As a matter of fact, it was the girl who made it. Nate was in love with this girl who worked at the Starbucks, and he often visited the place because of the girl. At first, you wouldn't know that he was infatuated by her, but the frequent visits and the occasional blushing when she was around made it certain that Nate wasn't at the place for the sake of coffee. It was the first time that I saw Nate acting weird and underconfident. You wouldn't cross him as someone who would be this blushing and so quiet. It was out of ordinary for him to act in such a way. But it was Nate. He was obsessive in everything he did. And this felt like one of those occasions. Every single time we went to the Starbucks, he would line up and switch lines when she wasn't the one serving the coffee. Then one day when we were sitting, I said to Nate, "Come on, man, you have to ask her out. You're freaking Nate. You're the boss, man." And Nate looked at me as he wanted to get back the confidence that he was losing and decided that he will ask the girl out. And he did. Her name was Natalie. And they were Nate and Natalie and looked so good together. But they were meant to be together. They were pretty much in love. And now that Nate had Natalie, he would spend much less time. Nate even thanked me when they got together as if I did everything. Nate and Natalie were going perfectly. And now we would hang out more in the Starbucks and get more and more free coffees. They were all good and tight. When one day, something happened that forever changed everything. It was the usual Friday night, and we were all at the Starbucks. Nate was sitting around, and Natalie was waiting for the shift to get over, and then from the front gate, the guy came in. His name was Michael. Michael was one of those quiet kids that always had a thing for Natalie. He came inside, and straight away came over to our table and said to Nate, "You're not good enough for Natalie. You'll never be. And you try, I will make sure you die." And then Nate said, "All right, man," and then shrugged him off. But that must have pissed off Michael, because the next thing he did was took the gun out and then shot Nate in his chest. There was nothing but silence. Nate's blood spattered across my face, and I was in shock of everything. And Nate was lying lifeless, and I was in complete trauma of losing my friend. And then that was the day that I last entered the Starbucks. There are still flashbacks of the incident that keep me awake in the night. The secret of mine is that I've always wanted to SAS a customer as you read online. You know, the kind where a person asks to see the manager and the staff member does a flamboyant 180-degree spin and says, "That's me." I got to live that dream. Although that being said, I think it's nearly got me quite badly hurt, too. A few years back, a customer had come into our branch of Starbucks an hour or so earlier and booked a table for his girlfriend and himself and left some table decor he wanted to set the table up with. It seemed a little weird, but nevertheless, I offered to set up roses, LED candles, and cloth napkins for them so they could leave to get ready. I finished setting up the table when in walks Mr. Businessman. The store is basically empty at this point. It's 4:30 in the afternoon, too early for any sort of dinner rush, and so there are lots of tables free. Mr. Businessman walks up and asks to use the table clearly set up for a romantic night. I politely said it's been reserved, but there are many other tables he can take a seat at, but insists that he has that table. I take him to the table directly next to it and say this table is free, but he doesn't want that seat. He wants the reserved seat. He starts to raise his voice, and at that point, I can see he is choosing to be difficult for no other reason but to be difficult. I repeat myself, that table is reserved, and that's when he says it. He asks to see the manager. I feel the moment it spread through my whole body, starting from my suddenly beaming smile all the way to my fingertips and overworked feet. I feel the power I suddenly possess flow over me. This is it. This is my moment. I look around, then down at my name badge and gasp as it says manager under my name. I smile and say, "That's me, sir. I'm the manager. I was being awful and petty, and he's beyond angry at this point and raises his finger, stabbing the air around me and says, "What's your name? I'll be reporting you to head office." And that was honestly the least of my worries. Like, for a little while, I legitimately thought this guy was going to hurt me was honestly worth it. To make this guy so angry, this absolute psycho, to pay for my witty little comment with my health or life. I think I got very lucky, because he leaves in an angry huff and says he'll be taking his business elsewhere. He ended up returning an hour later, and there's now a regular in our store. He greets me by my name every time he comes in.
My grandpa used to work as a stevedore over in Savannah, and he'd tell us all kinds of stories from his time on the job. Like one time, they got a whole shipment of bananas from the Philippines or somewhere, and back in those days they'd transport the bananas still attached to the big old branches that they grew on. They'd pop the crate, and then carefully pull the bananas out wearing real thick pairs of gloves, and they wore those gloves because of the tarantulas. The tarantulas didn't eat the bananas, but other, smaller, creepy crawlies would, making the banana branches a prime feeding ground for them. Most of the time, the workers over on the other side of the ocean would do their best to get all the bugs off their produce, but every so often, a tarantula would tuck itself away among the bunches after getting its fill of bugs, and then survive the entire transit process from whatever tropical islands that they were from to the ports of the United States. My grandpa said that one time he was working with this guy popping crates of bananas when the guy started to get a little too comfortable. He starts getting slow, talking when he should have been working, and then the next thing, Grandpa's turning around to see this guy's arm deep in a crate, but looking back at Grandpa trying to talk to him and paying no mind to what he was doing. Grandpa said that the second he turned around, he saw this huge, hairy spider just slowly wandering up the guy's arm, biggest thing he'd ever seen during all those years on the job. The guy couldn't feel it because of the big, thick, elbow-length glove that they used to wear to prevent spider bites and whatnot. Grandpa freezes, scared out of his wits, and then just points at the thing crawling up the guy's arm. Only then does the guy actually pay attention to what he's doing. But by then, it was too late. He sees the spider, then lets out this almighty yelp of terror, but this only succeeds in freaking the spider out too. I'm guessing the thing just kind of reacted on instinct and moved to neutralize the threat, so to speak. And still, instead of just jumping off his arm or something, the tarantula runs up the guy's sleeve, then makes this crazy leap right at the guy's face. Grandpa said that the guy's second scream, the one he did when the tarantula hit his face, was just about the loudest and most terrifying noise he'd ever heard. It was like a death scream or something, like the kind of sound a person can only make when they're in fear for their lives. Grandpa said that he did the first thing that came to mind, which was grab something to try and whack the spider off the guy's face. He grabbed a broom, and then turned to run back over to his coworker, but saw that he'd already batted the spider off of him and was running for the door of the warehouse. They get outside, slam the door behind them, and Grandpa's checking if the guy is okay when he sees these two big puncture marks on the guy's lower cheek from where the spider had bit him. Again, Grandpa is dumbstruck with fright, and all he can do is quietly point towards where this guy's been bit. I think maybe he just didn't know that he had been bitten, maybe from the adrenaline or what have you, but a moment later, the guy puts a hand to his face and realizes that he's been bitten, and then promptly passes out. Grandpa thought that the guy was dead. He thought the spider's venom had gone straight to the guy's brain and killed him dead in an instant. But then, the same deadly spider is now loose in one of the warehouses, so Grandpa goes running off to warn everyone that his coworker was dead and that there'd be more deaths if they didn't get the hell out of the area. He starts screaming at everyone to run for their lives because some deadly spider just jumped out of a crate and killed the guy he was working with. And this causes a full-blown panic on the docks, with half the guys running to save their skins and the other half organizing impromptu hunting parties so they could track the spider down and kill it. In truth, the guy who had been bitten wasn't dead at all, he just passed out, like I said. But then the area around the bite got so swollen and red so fast that even though the guy woke up and started wandering around, confused, it didn't really do much to calm the situation down. The reality was that even though the bites from the spider were very nasty, they weren't even close to deadly. But since this was like the late 50s or something, there was no Discovery Channel back then, and folks just kind of assumed that every tropical tarantula had a bite that could kill a man stone dead in mere minutes. You had all these stevedores running around with just about any kind of weapon they could get their hands on, until finally, one of the bosses got wind of what was going on. He shut the place down for the night, called in animal control, and they sent a guy over to find and trap the spider before they took it over to some museum or something for identification. The guy who got bit spent the night in the hospital and then was back at work just a few days later. We always enjoyed hearing that story, but the thing is, that wasn't even the scariest or craziest story my grandpa had from his time as a stevedore. He'd always break the spider story out for the younger crowd at family gatherings, and after miming all the spider stuff with his fingers of one hand, he'd almost always have all the little girls running off in disgust while all the little boys sat around him, completely enraptured by the tale of an encounter with a great hairy monster. But then, after they'd all gone to bed or their parents had taken them home, he'd break out the wilder stories for the adults. Most of these consisted of things like fellas sneaking their girlfriends onto the job with them, then getting caught catching 7 minutes in heaven together in a back office or shipping container, or the time they stole a whole crate of scotch because they realized that there was a mistake on one of the shipping manifests. The right call would have been to simply correct the manifest, but nope, almost $5,000 worth of luxury scotch went poof and disappeared, and everyone had a very Merry Christmas that year. But then on one occasion, he told us a straight-up horror story. Back during his first year of being a stevedore, my grandpa worked with this guy called Crazy Al. Al was a war veteran, as in, he was in the army during World War II. The guys on the docks knew that he served in the Pacific Islands, and they knew that he'd seen some pretty messed up stuff too, but that was it. No one ever asked Crazy Al about the stuff that he'd seen or where he'd fought because no one wanted to upset him, and no one wanted to upset him because, like I said, he's Crazy Al. My grandpa said everyone felt for the guy, but that he wasn't particularly popular neither, on account of him being almost impossible to work with. Crazy Al couldn't be around loud noises, and woe betide anyone who accidentally startled him, so instead of working the warehouses and whatnot like the rest of the workers, Grandpa said Crazy Al was kept in the equipment room, where folks went to get tools, slings, safety gear, and things of that nature. You just didn't walk in, either. You knocked really softly on the door till Al came to ask you what you wanted, and that way, he was kept at a safe distance from everyone else. Anyway, one day the docks get this big old cargo ship coming in, only right away, they can tell something is different about it, because some of the containers had different kinds of letters on them. It turns out, the ship had come all the way from South Korea, and since the country was rebuilding from the war at that time, I figured this was one of the first Korean ships to dock in America for quite a while. So the ship docks, and these two Korean officers walk down the gangplank to greet the foreman in perfect English. They exchange a few words, discuss the unloading of their ship, then off they went back to their quarters while the stevedores got to work. Sometime later, Crazy Al comes out of the equipment shed for some reason. Someone later said that they saw him walk out, and when he saw the ship floating in the dock, he just stopped and stared at it, like he was hypnotized or something. According to my grandpa, this person mentioned Crazy Al's episode to one of his coworkers, but since Al had more than earned his nickname by that point, it was kind of like, what else is new? And so the last people saw of Al, he was marching across the dock with a crowbar in hand, heading straight for the gangplank of the Korean ship. Then the next thing, everyone on the dock started to hear screaming coming from it. And there are screams and shouts all in Korean, and from the sounds of things, it was like they were having some kind of fight up there. Then the next thing, gunshots. And so everyone scatters and the cops get called. Everyone's still sort of hiding out, keeping an eye on the ship when the cops show up and run aboard with their guns drawn. And there, they find Crazy Al, shot to death with a crowbar in his hand. Then in the vicinity were two dead Koreans, beat to death by Al, and about half a dozen wounded Korean soldiers, one of which had shot Crazy Al dead with a gun that they kept on board for emergencies. For years, everyone kind of figured that Al had mistaken the Koreans for Japanese, which is obviously one of the two countries we were at war with while Al was serving as a soldier. But the truth is much more disturbing. You see, as it turned out, Al had been a prisoner in a Japanese POW camp, a particularly brutal one too. He'd seen his fellow soldiers tortured, executed, and slowly worked to death over the course of 2 to 3 years. He learned to hate the camp's guards. But not all of them were Japanese. Part of Japan's conquest of Asia included the Korean Peninsula, and they gave a lot of Koreans a chance to prove their loyalty to their new masters by serving as guards in their prisoner of war camps. Then, to prove just how fanatically loyal they really were, they treated American POWs way, way crueler than the Japanese did, as a way of winning over their new masters. And Crazy Al probably had his very own Korean camp guard, and I'm not saying it could possibly excuse what he did to those poor sailors, but it certainly explains why he turned so murderous just at the sight of them. The thing is, folks just carried on thinking Al was crazy. Couldn't tell the difference between Korean and Japanese, they'd say. Stupid old Crazy Al, crazier than a poop house rat. But then, it seems to me and my grandpa that Al wasn't all that crazy after all. Sure, he was disturbed, but there's a chilling kind of clarity to him choosing to take vengeance like that. The way my grandpa tells it, he was just quiet. He didn't run across the docks, screaming and cursing, waving his crowbar around. He just walked, all cool and calm to try and commit a massacre without saying a word. And that little detail never fails to creep me out.